don't shut the door on refuge, on refugees. We are a city of sanctuary, of refuge, and also of defense of our Constitution. The green card holders who have been vetted, travelers from a foreign land coming to see a son or a daughter or a mother or a father. I was out here at the airport helping some of those reunifications. We had six seniors who themselves, survivors of stage 4 cancer, who could not be connected with their family members. That has to end.
LA Mayor Eric Garcetti at a news conference at LAX earlier this month. That was during the travel ban confusion. And we played that cut to demonstrate how the mayor talks about the idea of Los Angeles being a sanctuary city. Notice he said city of sanctuary, not sanctuary city. He says the city is committed to protecting immigrants, but he has not explicitly declared LA a sanctuary city. And he has explained that police do cooperate with ICE officials when they have a court-issued warrant, which has left advocacy groups and community members confused. Is LA a sanctuary city or isn't it? Well, Leighton Woodhouse recently wrote about this for the investigative website The Intercept, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what does the mayor mean when he says city of sanctuary, and how does that differ from sanctuary city? Is it just wording, or does it actually have something behind it?
Well, I'm probably as confused as you are by that. He has mentioned that phrase city of sanctuary at that LAX press conference. After that, he reaffirmed it, I believe, once to somebody who I've spoken to. But other than that, he's kind of avoided that term as well. So as far as I can tell, he's avoided both terms. He may be trying to draw some sort of distinction between the two phrases when he mentioned it at the press conference. But it was only a few days after that press conference that he sort of started to back off that term, released a statement which mentioned sanctuary nowhere within it. So, you know, I think a lot of people are scratching their heads.
Well, could that be because Donald Trump has promised to sanction sanctuary cities?
That's an argument I've heard. It doesn't make sense to me. I don't believe, and I can't believe that the mayor believes, that Donald Trump is going to make his determination as to whether to cut off federal funds to Los Angeles based on whether some sort of magic word is used. LA is covered under Special Order 40, which is an LAPD directive. I think as long as that policy stands, and nobody's talking about taking that away, the mayor's not talking about removing it, nor is Chief Charlie Beck. As long as that's in place, I think LA is going to be in Trump's crosshairs.
Well, he declined to come on the show today. We asked him to come on, but they did send a statement, and he said in the statement, "We don't use the term sanctuary city since it has no definition and it has primarily been used by anti-immigrant organizations. LA has always been a welcoming city to refugees, to asylum seekers, and to immigrants."
I've heard that explanation as well. It makes even less sense to me. Sanctuary city is not a right-wing frame. It comes out of the immigrant rights movement. It's been embraced by immigrants. It's a phrase which brings quite a bit of solace to people who are vulnerable and exposed right now. It's just anything but a right-wing frame. It's not something that Frank Luntz cooked up in a basement somewhere. It's a common term embraced by immigrants.
Now, what about this $10 million fund to provide assistance to immigrants facing deportation?
Well, to the mayor's credit, he has pushed to set up this LA Justice Fund between the city and the county and a private philanthropy. The purpose of the fund is to provide due process to immigrants in removal proceedings. Right now, immigrants do not have a right to an attorney in removal proceedings. It's not like in criminal court where there's a guarantee of a public defender. So that's a good thing, in my opinion. The problem is that the mayor and city attorney Mike Feuer have been apparently pushing for carve-outs to that fund, exempting people who have criminal convictions in their background. That sounds probably to a lot of people like a reasonable thing because they think of rapists and murderers. And by the way, there's a lot of people who would say, no matter what you're charged, you should at least have an attorney. It doesn't mean you get to stay here, but you get due process. But in fact, we're talking about people who have, under the Obama administration, when they prioritized criminals for deportation, we're talking about people who had citations for unlicensed street vending, people who had simply ignored removal orders, people who had speeding tickets, people who had nothing at all.
They're all considered criminals.
Well, they have been by DHS under the Obama administration. Things are likely to get worse under Trump. But when you start to make those divisions between criminal and non-criminal in doling out representation for people, the concern by people in the immigrant rights movement is that, first of all, it's unfair on its face. Second of all, it's a slippery slope.
So what would they prefer that Garcetti do? And are their mayors actually doing more than Garcetti is when it comes to this?
They have been pushing for universal representation, meaning due process for everybody in immigration court, regardless of what your background is. It just means that you have an attorney. It doesn't mean that you have a right necessarily to stay here. That's up to the courts to adjudicate. Mm-hmm. Other mayors have been doing more, yes. Ed Lee up in San Francisco is suing the Trump administration over these threats to federal funds. The mayor of Boston has invited immigrants to take refuge in his office. And Rahm Emanuel even has embraced without any shame the term sanctuary city. So has Ed Lee and so has Bill de Blasio. A lot of these mayors are distinguishing themselves by really standing up to Trump. And I think that the mayor here has done some good things. The LA Justice Fund is a good thing. He said a lot of positive things about immigrants, and I think he should be applauded for that. But his refusal to acknowledge Los Angeles as a sanctuary city seems like an outlier.
Right. But again, could it just be semantics? I mean, you know, could he do everything, all but call it a sanctuary city, thereby avoid maybe possible legal entanglements, mm-hmm. but still, again, offer the $10 million, still say that they are welcoming to immigrants, et cetera?
I think the semantics are very important. L.A., one could argue that L.A. is not, in fact, a sanctuary city because while Special Order 40 is in place, which prohibits cops from being able to just pull over and detain and question people and ask for their papers, there is repeated and routine collaboration between ICE and the LAPD, between ICE and the sheriffs in the county jails. There's data sharing. There's joint operations between ICE and the LAPD. So in a way, perhaps LA is not a sanctuary city, but it's also a term of aspiration, not just description. And a lot of people in the immigrant rights movement who I've spoken to see his refusal to embrace that term as a rejection of this moral vision that they have, not just a legalistic distinction about what LA is or isn't.
Now, he is facing re-election. He's on the ballot, the primary ballot, on Tuesday. He doesn't face any serious opposition. So is he not going to pay a political price for this?
I don't think he's going to pay a political price between now and next Tuesday. But I think that after he is elected into office, and I think everybody knows that he will be, I think it's a good question. There are those who think that there's a growing frustration in LA about what's coming down the pike in terms of Trump's deportation, but what's already happened with these sweeps and the mayor's non-responsiveness to it. I've talked to a lot of people in this movement, and there's a lot of anger, and I think the mayor is going to learn about it, and will it add up to a political cost? I don't know. I can't say, but I think that there's a lot of frustration out there.
Leighton Woodhouse, freelance journalist and contributor to The Intercept. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Okay, do you think the mayor should declare the city a sanctuary city? Weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Well, Police Chief Charlie Beck has said the LAPD will not operate as an arm of the federal immigration enforcement.
Over 500,000 Angelenos, people that live in Los Angeles, are undocumented immigrants. I need their cooperation. I need them to be part of the fabric of Los Angeles if we're going to keep this city safe. And for a local law enforcement agency to take on the role of immigration enforcement tears that fabric apart.
But there are ways in which the LAPD does work with ICE, as we just heard in the last segment. Elliot Young has been looking into this and into how other cities interact with ICE. He's a professor of history and director of ethnic studies at Lewis and Clark, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Well, as we just heard from Chief Beck, LAPD says it will not collaborate with ICE. But what are the ways in which it does cooperate with ICE?
Yeah, I mean, I think in L.A. and mayors in New York and throughout the country, in Portland as well, have been saying this, that their police will not collaborate with ICE. But the facts on the ground tell us something completely differently, that in L.A. we know that there are cases going back a couple of years of raids on these so-called casitas, which are done in collaboration with ICE. There is direct sharing of information with ICE in Portland, which is a sanctuary city, declared sanctuary city, in a state, which is a declared sanctuary state, which prohibits sharing of information we find out that actually the deputy sheriffs have been collaborating and calling ICE and emailing them and letting them know when particular undocumented immigrants are going to be coming into the court. And then the ICE agents show up in the courthouse and arrest people there. So I think that one way in which the label sanctuary is disingenuous is when you have police collaborating at that level with ICE. The secondary part is that you have, in many of these cities, broken windows policing, which means police arresting people for low-level offenses like public urination, selling mango slices without a license. And once those people get criminalized, picked up, and booked, they're fingerprinted. Those fingerprints are sent to the FBI, and that information is then available to ICE. Hmm. So unless cities end their broken windows policing and stop criminalizing populations that are largely populations of color, sanctuary is meaningless.
Well, here in Los Angeles, we do have Special Order 40, which prohibits this kind of collaboration that Chief Beck was talking about. In other words, officers can't ask people when they arrest them for their papers if they're legal or not. And they generally don't hold them beyond if they've served jail time. They don't hold them for ICE to then pick them up afterwards. And so is that just, window dressing in a way? Is that the spirit of the law, but not the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law is being violated?
Well, clearly the letter of the law is being violated in these cases where the LAPD is in collaboration, direct collaboration with ICE. But I think the larger question is this question of the arrest in the first place, because once they are arrested, the information goes to the federal government. And so whether the LAPD is getting on the phone and calling up ICE or not, they're basically delivering immigrants, undocumented immigrants, to the hands of ICE. So I think that they need to both enforce the regulations that they have on the books as well as stop criminalizing immigrant populations and populations of color.
Now, we have been talking a lot about the Trump's administration's new policies when it comes to undocumented immigrants and these big sweeps we were talking about. And I'm wondering, has there been a big shift in what actually happens on the ground? There seems to be a lot of fear in immigrant communities, but there have been ICE raids going on for years.
Yeah, there have been ICE raids going on for years under Obama. As I explained in this article in the Huffington Post, under Obama's tenure, he deported more immigrants than anyone before, and the majority of those were people without any criminal convictions. And if you look at ICE in particular, you can see that most of the people who were deported, the vast majority, we're talking over 60%, were people without felonies. And so this idea that Obama declared, felons, not families, and we're going to target gangbangers and felons, first of all, wasn't true. And secondly, by using that language is essentially criminalizing immigrant population. So like your previous guest said, I think once you go down that road of starting to see immigrants as criminals, very quickly you realize that lots of people get swept up in that. And so in that sense, Obama and Trump have pretty much the same policy. I think the difference is now is the overtly racist rhetoric, the expansion of the guidelines so that criminal means anything, including people suspected of doing something which is a chargeable offense, are now priorities for Department of Homeland Security, which really means that except for the 750,000 DACA students, the other 10 million immigrants are priorities for deportation. So when Trump talks about criminals, let's be clear, really he's talking about every immigrant who doesn't have papers in the country.
And that is something different than what President Obama said. The rhetoric is different, and many immigrant rights activists are saying the actual actions on the ground are different, that perhaps on paper there isn't a lot of difference, but when it came to actually carrying out raids, ICE was not targeting everybody.
Well, in the recent raid, the five-day raid where they picked up 680 people, ICE claims that they're targeting people with criminal convictions, but what they've been doing is just picking up people who they call collateral arrests, anyone who they happen to find who doesn't have papers. And like in the case in Seattle where they picked up, but they went after the father of someone who was a DACA student, they picked him up and then claimed that he had admitted to being a gang member with sort of falsified, doctored papers. And so I think the other element of this is the designation of gang, and in LA they have a whole database of gang, is very sort of loose and fishy, and they could just put people on this list, and then that makes them a priority for ICE deportation, and they don't have the ability to they don't have legal protections to fight against it. So the criminalizing of these populations, I think, is really the fundamental problem.
Elliot Young, professor of history and director of ethnic studies at Lewis and Clark College. You can read his article about deportation policy in the Huffington Post. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the LA-based artist Jason Rhodes. He's the subject of a major show at Hauser & Wirth. We'll find out how he represents what is unique about California art. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Jason Rhodes is, in many ways, the embodiment of contemporary Los Angeles art. His works are massive installations. They take up entire rooms, and they mix highbrow and lowbrow art culture and pop culture. There are cars and consumer goods and porn. Jason Rhodes died from a drug overdose when he was 41 years old, just as his career was beginning to peak. He won acclaim in Europe and New York for his work, but he was less known here in his adopted hometown. And that's why the Arts District Gallery, Hauser & Wirth, is mounting a major new exhibition of Rhodes' work. Before he left Hauser & Wirth last week, chief curator Paul Schimmel gave me a tour.
Instagram didn't exist when Jason made these. He seemed to somehow channel the inner Instagram in everybody, because it's like, you know, kind of like perfect.
Jason Rhodes died almost 11 years ago, way before Instagram. But everywhere you turn in the exhibition, there are photo-ready pops of color, touches of irony, and, yeah, sex. Take, for example, the very first piece you see. It's called Swedish Erotica. The room is packed with furniture he made from cardboard, styrofoam, and plastic. It's a play on a certain ubiquitous Swedish furniture store.
This is a massive installation. It takes up a good portion of the gallery space. What we're seeing is a whole bunch of different objects in yellow and white. And just before you even look at anything closely, it just, in a way, looks like storage, like items that you would find maybe in an attic or in a showroom, but this is obviously very carefully put together.
The showroom is the key. The structure here was very clearly an IKEA shop. So each one of these represents a bedroom, living room, dining room.
Mixed into this showroom layout, though, are some of Rhodes' own personal items, like a photo of his mother and his own rudimentary high school pottery projects. Rhodes was born just outside Sacramento in rural Newcastle. He moved to the Bay Area to attend California College of the Arts and later San Francisco Art Institute. He eventually made his way down to LA to get his master's at UCLA. There, he studied under Paul McCarthy and Chris Burden, who were major influences on him. But despite his formal arts education, Jason Rhodes loved working with things like toilet paper, folding chairs, plastic buckets.
By reimagining them and putting them in this exhibition and associating them with other objects, he's sort of elevating the throwaway?
California has an extraordinary tradition of assemblage. And whether you look at Bay Area artists like Bruce Conner or our own Ed Keenholz and his highly charged, politicized environments, what seems as if it was made for one purpose can very easily, in a way, be repurposed.
One installation, made in 1995, juxtaposes photos of the studio of famous 20th century sculptor Brancusi with photos of Rhodes' brother's suburban bedroom. The middle of the room looks like someone's cluttered garage with moving dollies, pieces of old wood, and a donut fryer. Dozens of small donuts are stacked on top of each other. And here, Rhodes is referencing one of Brancusi's most famous sculptures, Endless Column.
And there's something really scary about all of this. These are the original donuts.
I thought you had made these specially for the exhibition.
No, we thought we might have to, but when they were uncrated, they were in remarkably good condition. Scarily so.
You've just ruined donuts for me. Thank you.
It's that play on consumption and consumer culture that helped catapult Rhodes to success in the art world.
That kind of sort of both random and then articulated overlaying of history, personal, social, high, low, is something, it's the kind of sort of strange magic that he brought together.
The mashing of personal and political becomes more pronounced later in one of the exhibition's most striking pieces. It's called My Medina. It's like a prayer room in a mosque, but with a twist.
There are towels of different colors and sizes all over the floor, and hanging from the ceiling are dozens and dozens of neon signs.
Several hundred.
Several hundred.
Yeah. 240 slang terms for female genitalia.
Oh. And only 240.
Only 240. Although there is a book that had thousands that he had come up with. And so this is part mosque, part sanctuary.
Rhodes created My Medina in 2004 when the American wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were particularly intense.
But what was his interest in Islam?
You know, I think he took a real interest in the culture. I think it was also the time. You had had 9/11. You had had this new war. So it's political work. It's religious. And then there's something very personal about this, too. He's married to an Iraqi Jew. The only way you can experience this work is you take your shoes off, like you would going into a mosque, and you sit down and you contemplate. And this is his universe, both religious and profane, next to each other.
But it's also funny. I mean, it's serious.
Darkly funny. And that is, I mean, I think Jason was a kind of joyous person. I mean, just buoyant in his energy, enthusiastic beyond a kind of childlike wonder.
You can see the humor in the name of the last piece, Tijuana Tangier Chandelier. It rhymes. It's filled with souvenir shop tchotchkes Rhodes picked up in both cities, like ceramic donkeys and maracas. And again, hanging above and woven into the chandeliers, those neon signs.
So we're seeing the chandeliers are actually, again, neon signs.
176 neon Spanish and English slang terms, again, for female genitalia.
What's with the obsession with female genitalia?
Don't know. Is he pushing against the politics of the time, or is he pushing against the art world?
He's also critiquing globalism and the spread of consumer culture worldwide.
This is represents these two border towns, culturally border towns, and trying to make something functional. I mean, these are all chandeliers. They're all independent pieces, and they literally mix up both the language, the words, and the objects from different cultures.
They're also for sale.
So I guess because you are a gallery, are you selling these objects?
Sure, hope so.
How much would one of these chandeliers cost?
I don't know.
Like six, seven figures.
Enough. As much as you can kind of sort of say, oh, well, okay. It was like trying to be a good businessman in some ways. But he did everything to run against it, right? Functionality, consumer goods. He was sending the kind of mixed messages, sort of like, okay, well, we're going to take the art world and we're going to smack it.
It's a smack the art world embraced, and Schimmel hopes Los Angeles art fans will also embrace Jason Rhodes as one of their own. The exhibition at Hauser & Wirth in the Arts District is up until the end of May. Coming up, there's an initiative on the March 7th ballot that's dividing communities and forcing many Angelenos to ask, who is the city for?
Kind of like what you hear when you're growing up, that the rising tide lifts all boats, but I'm not sure that people in small boats wrote that, you know?
Both sides of the Measure S debate next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I know a lot of you are still hungover from the election in November, but guess what? There's another election coming up next Tuesday, a local election. And one of the most closely watched items on the ballot in the city of Los Angeles is Measure S. Maybe you've seen the billboards or the mailers or some of the pretty ugly back and forth on social media. Passions are running really high over Measure S because it would make big changes as to how and where Los Angeles grows. KCR W's Saul Gonzalez and Anna Scott teamed up for our story on Measure S. Hi, you guys.
Hello.
Well, first, Anna, what is in this initiative?
So basically, Measure S is calling for a big timeout on certain kinds of large development projects that you see around the city. It would put a two-year halt on projects that need certain kinds of exemptions from the land use rules and the zoning rules that we have now. And Saul, you can take it from there if I'm missing anything, but I think that's the nut of it.
Yeah, and some say that these exemptions are responsible for a lot of these mega projects we see going up around Los Angeles, Madeline. And the man behind Measure S is perhaps a surprising figure. He's Michael Weinstein, and he runs the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is located in Hollywood. They've done, you know, incredibly important work when it comes to AIDS education, fighting HIV. But he believes that creating or safeguarding a certain kind of Los Angeles, an LA that kind of was created in the 20th century, is important. He doesn't like the way the city is going in terms of the number of projects being built and how that's affecting neighborhoods. And he says that this is squarely part of his organization's mission.
So I understand you went out to find out more from supporters of Measure S.
We went to a neighborhood where these issues and these concerns about growth are playing out like nowhere else in the city. And here's our story. If you want to see how development is transforming enormous swaths of Los Angeles and why that's made Measure S such a big deal, Hollywood is a good place to go. The sights and sounds of new development here are everywhere. So many big projects, in fact, the neighborhood can feel like one big construction zone. And Cesar Vega is in the middle of it. And I mean literally in the middle of it. What is that wall going to be? Is that like a parking structure, retaining wall?
My understanding is that that side is going to be parking, and then this is going to be more residential. So we'll have, not only will we have a wall, we'll have windows of people looking down on us as well.
A massive 500-unit apartment complex is being built on three sides of Caesar's quaint Spanish-style cottage that he rents a block south of Hollywood Boulevard. The concrete walls of the new development just inches from the property line.
So we're outside your backyard. Tell me what we both see.
All right, you're looking at tons and tons of cranes flying over your head, and our tiny little palm trees that used to hover over the block, and now they're dwarfed by these ugly monsters.
Caesar grew up in Hollywood and owns a small production company that he runs out of his house. He says what's being built around his cottage is part of a wider development trend in the neighborhood, the kind of development Measure S supporters say their initiative will curtail.
There's been a Manhattanization of Hollywood specifically.
Manhattanization.
Yeah, you know, you're going vertical. There's as many people as you can cram into, one block. And there's construction after construction being built for, you know, who knows who the people are. And the way that, from what I've read, the way that the city approaches it can be looked at like it's an improvement. It's a benefit to everybody. Kind of like what you hear when you're growing up, that I heard it a lot, the rising tide lifts all boats, but I'm not sure that people in small boats wrote that, you know?
When it comes to housing, Caesar, echoing Measure S proponents, says a lot of what's getting built in Hollywood and other LA neighborhoods is way, way beyond the ability of most working and middle-class Angelenos to ever live in them. Take this place, for example, just a block east of Caesar's cottage.
So this is a three-bedroom, three-bathroom penthouse with amazing wraparound balcony that faces up into the Hollywood Hills.
I'm in the Hollywood proper, a new 200-unit luxury residential tower. Rent for an unfurnished 847-square-foot apartment here starts at $3,700 a month. But that's a bargain compared to the penthouse, where the property's representative, Joshua Katz, is giving me a tour.
All right, if I want to move in, how much?
This one is probably starting at $36,000 a month, and this one actually hasn't been revealed to the general public yet, so you're getting a nice little sneak peek. So I'd say it's about 99% done.
To supporters of Measure S, the Hollywood proper is a 23-story tall poster child of what's wrong with so much new development in L.A. They say it's out of scale with the rest of the neighborhood, and it's too pricey, possibly encouraging landlords in the area to boost their rents, forcing longtime residents out. As they campaign to pass their slow-growth ballot initiative, Measure S supporters are offering this warning to L.A. communities. The development blitz happening in Hollywood might soon happen in your neighborhood, unless Measure S passes.
Millionaires and even billionaires are interested in the LA River. They are interested in developing it in a completely different way that you have never imagined in your life, and that does not include, in fact, the people who live here now.
That's Jill Stewart, the director of the Yes on S campaign, addressing a community meeting in Elysian Valley. It's a largely working-class Latino neighborhood of small, single-family homes along the banks of the LA River. And it's been relatively unaffected by past LA development booms. However, Elysian Valley is changing as plans move forward to improve the LA River.
Mostly white, affluent people are moving in and pretty much taking it over.
Elena Lovelace has lived in Elysian Valley for 60 years and worries new development here will bring gentrification.
The last two or three years has been big developers that are coming in, real estate agents that are offering thousands of dollars to residents, longtime residents, and to businesses so that they could sell out. And so the developers could come in and build a multi-unit condos, businesses, and I just feel that in the long run, the developers are out to make money, and they just don't respect the people that are living here.
Now, even if it passes, Measure S will not completely stop gentrification and displacement in L.A., but it has tapped into something many Angelenos are feeling, a kind of we're-not-going-to-take-it-anymore resentment in reaction to new development in the city. Here's Yes on S's Jill Stewart.
We're saying, look, the mess has already arrived. Look around you. Do you like how the city is operating? Do you like what you see on the streets and in your neighborhood? And so we go around the city everywhere we go. Regular, everyday people, from the poor to the rich, are pissed off and sick of it.
In Hollywood, Cesar Vega says he's not opposed to all new development, and he doesn't know how he's going to vote a Measure S. But Cesar speaks for many when he says that a lot of what's getting built in L.A. doesn't seem to be tangibly improving people's lives. He also says the pace of change because of development can make him feel like a stranger in his own city.
I don't see myself in a lot of the things that are that are happening. I'm not in victim mode, but it's not I'm not part of that circle. Even though I grew up here, even though I know the city pretty darn well, and I feel like in a way I'm a holdout. A lot of the people that I know left. A lot of the people that I grew up with aren't here anymore. Let alone the buildings that everyone used to live in and the homes that everybody used to live in, which are, have been bulldozed. It's a tough city to be in, you know?
So Madeline and Anna, I mean, that's what you've just heard is a lot of the kind of feelings that are powering support or interest in Measure S. And it's really this kind of alienation people feel from this Los Angeles that's really changing around them right before their very eyes in neighborhoods like Hollywood and other places.
Okay, so that's the pro side, pro Measure S. Anna, you went out to get the opposite view.
I did, yes. And there are a lot of people opposed to Measure S. There's a big coalition against it, which not surprisingly includes developers, but also City Hall, Mayor Eric Garcetti, dozens of affordable housing and homeless organizations, labor. And basically, they say that we have a housing shortage. And this is one of the reasons that housing is so expensive for so many people, and that Measure S would just make that worse, that prices would go up, jobs, including construction jobs, would go down. Those are the big arguments, but I wanted to take a more on-the-ground look at how this is playing out in neighborhoods. So we heard in Saul's piece about this man, Caesar, who lives in Hollywood, who feels like a stranger in his own neighborhood because of all the new construction going on. Well, I went to downtown, which is another construction hotspot, and I talked to a man named Shane Phillips, who also lives around a lot of new construction but has a very different perspective on it.
I try to find stuff that's new whenever I can. Right over on, I think, 8th and Los Angeles is Sonora Town, and that just opened a few months ago, and that's a really great taco spot.
Shane is 32 years old, and he rents a large studio apartment at 6th and Spring Streets for $16.50 a month. Not cheap, but he saves money by choosing not to have a car.
I work at 9th and Broadway, which is about 3 blocks away, so in the morning I just walk over there. I take the
And he lives near train and bus lines that get him most other places. Shane volunteers for an advocacy group called Abundant Housing LA that opposes Measure S. And he embraces a kind of urban lifestyle that Measure S opponents say more Angelenos should have access to. They argue that one of the best solutions to LA's soaring housing prices and gridlock is to build more, especially near public transportation.
As legitimate as the Yes on Measure S people's argument about the planning system being broken is, their solution doesn't actually fix any of the problems that they've identified and in many cases makes it worse.
Worse because it would intensify the housing shortage that's driving up prices. But of course, the fight over Measure S is about more than supply and demand. Do you think that in some way it's a fight over LA's identity and the kind of city that we want to be going forward?
I think it absolutely is. There are some people who think that Measure S will be good for affordability, and those people are wrong. But there are other people who think that I just like my neighborhood the way it is, and that is my highest priority. You know, I don't really have anything to say to those people, because if that's your highest priority, then, you know, that's your prerogative. But what we found is that people keep moving here anyway. We just are less prepared to deal with it than if we had actually planned for that growth.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Casa Hewa. This was developed by Little Tokyo Service Center 20 years ago.
One morning last month, representatives from 32 affordable housing and tenants' rights organizations held a No on S press conference downtown. They gathered on the roof of Casa Hewa, an affordable building in Little Tokyo.
Don't be misled by the banners that say, protect your neighborhoods. Protect your neighborhoods from who?
The speakers at the event, like Shane Phillips, argued that Measure S would drive up prices for everyone, and that it would even block some affordable projects. Rabia Sen is the director of policy for the South LA nonprofit Esperanza Community Housing Corporation. She said she doesn't believe the backers of Measure S when they say it's a way for the little guy to stand up to big money developers.
These are people who've never worked on housing issues, who've never worked with low-income communities, and who wrote this measure without actually involving any of us who've been doing this work for a long time.
The original name for Measure S, the Neighborhood Integrity Initiative, also set off alarm bells for Rabia.
Historically, neighborhood integrity has you know, another way to talk about it is we don't want them in our neighborhoods, not in my backyard. It's painful to hear that.
Rabia doesn't see Measure S as a solution, but she does acknowledge the alienation some people feel over rising rents and expensive new housing projects. And one person who's experienced that anxiety is Jackie Valladares. Jackie's 27 years old, born and raised in Echo Park. She's been active in local politics since she was a teenager, and now she sits on the Echo Park Neighborhood Council. And on a recent rainy afternoon, we met at her house to talk about Measure S. She showed me photos on her phone of the three-bedroom rent-controlled apartment she grew up in.
This is how it used to look. We had like a little hammock and all that stuff. And they
her family had to give up the apartment a few years ago when a new landlord bought the property. He later renovated it and raised the rents. Now, Jackie lives with her parents and her brother in a much smaller but more expensive two-bedroom house in Echo Park.
When I was like little, I said to myself, I'm going to live on my own. Like, I'm going to have my own apartment. And I feel guilty because I could live on my own, but my parents wouldn't be able to live here.
That's because Jackie contributes to the rent, which is $1,600 a month. Not unlike Caesar, who you heard earlier in Hollywood, or Elena from Elysian Valley, Jackie knows what it's like to feel squeezed out of her own neighborhood. But she's read Measure S and says this.
Gentrification is actually gonna be worse if Measure S passes.
She'd like to see city housing policies that create new affordable housing or stronger rent control protections. But Measure S doesn't do those things.
I do realize we live in a breathing city. Like, it's gonna grow. Communities change. But we're gonna absorb a lot of people in the next coming years. And to fit everyone and to stop construction, it just doesn't make sense.
LA is going to grow and change whether we like it or not, Jackie says. And a vote for Measure S is like a vote for sticking our heads in the sand about the need to adapt to those changes.
Okay, the arguments against Measure S there brought to you by Anna Scott. Anna, thank you.
You're welcome.
And earlier we heard arguments for Measure S brought to us by Saul Gonzalez. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Madeline.
And now it's your turn. Tuesday, time to go vote. March 7th, head to the polls to vote yes or no on Measure S and everything else that's on your ballot. Coming up on this program, more on Measure S. Those mailers you may have received, they make some pretty outrageous claims. One even implies Donald Trump backs the No on S side. We'll have more on that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Before the break, we heard pro and con arguments about Measure S. That's the measure that puts a hold on new big developments that need zoning changes to be approved. LA City voters will see it on their ballots next Tuesday. But if you live inside the city's borders, you're already well aware of this measure, if for no other reason than all those mailers that have been showing up in your mailbox. Well, it turns out that some of them are a little bit less than honest. For example, some of the Yes on S mailers include quotes from the LA Times that make it sound like the paper has endorsed the measure when in fact the Times has editorialized against it. Emily Alpert-Reyes is City Hall reporter for the Times. She has nothing to do with the editorial side of the paper, but she's been writing about those mailers and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. Well, one of the other mailers has a picture of Eric Garcetti on it and a quote, "I agree," several times. But the mayor has come out pretty strongly against Measure S, right? So what is he so-called agreeing
to? Yeah, this
is
interesting. And this actually follows earlier that the Yes on S campaign had used a photo of Eric Garcetti in an email blast to its supporters. And the mayor had sent out a statement calling it a dirty trick, saying that, you know, they should cease and desist from doing anything to make it look like he was a supporter of Measure S. Maybe a week later, this mailer comes out with an enormous picture of his smiling face next to the words, "I agree." Now, they're quoting from a letter that he wrote to supporters of Measure S last year, saying that there were some of their goals that he agreed with, some reforms that he wanted to undertake. But the letter itself was actually urging them to not move forward with the ballot measure. So Garcetti's camp has been very concerned that this is giving a misleading impression to voters that he's in support of the ballot measure when he is very, very much against it.
Yeah, and it might be confusing to voters because his face is also on the anti-Measure S mailers.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the one good thing it probably means for him is that if people are so intent on using his face on their mailers, they must think it's good for them. So at least it speaks to the sense that the mayor is relatively popular, but they've not been happy about those mailers.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit about this other mailer that's received some controversy, and this is a mailer that looks like an eviction notice from the sheriff's department, and the sheriff's department said, "Don't send these out anymore. Stop it." But the Measure S people are still sending them out.
Yeah, so it's very striking looking. It has, you know, in big, you know, red type eviction notice, and above it says County of Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. And the county council who represents the sheriff's department sent them a letter saying, you know, this is an improper use of the sheriff's department's name. It's misleading. You need to send out a message to everyone that got that mailer telling them that the sheriff's department didn't authorize the use of their name. It doesn't support the message. The Yes on S campaign responded yesterday saying, nope, we're not going to do that. We think your concerns are completely overblown. They said they didn't think there was any way that someone could mistake the mailers for a real eviction notice, and that they were protected political speech.
So they're going to keep sending them out? And there's nothing...
You know, in their letter, they say that it's probably pretty unlikely that they would send this particular mailer out again, given that the election's a week away.
Right.
But they argue that, you know, hey, there's no reason why we can't.
They did send one out yesterday. Well, I received it yesterday, that links the No on S side to Donald Trump, saying that he might be, or his associates might be behind this, or linking them as associates with Donald Trump, the No on S backers. Can you talk about that?
You know, I haven't had a chance to really look into that one as much. Another issue that has come up is the arguments about the impact on homeless veterans. I believe there was a mailer. There was definitely a billboard that talked about housing homeless vets. And the Yes on S campaign basically argues that, well, if we stop these, you know, they call them mega developments, that it's going to stop the incentivization of tearing down rent-controlled apartments, and that affects vulnerable groups like veterans more than others. That was a key point they made at this press conference this morning. The No on S campaign has said, look, this is a total red herring. There's nothing in this ballot measure but specific to housing veterans. You know, some people have even tried to argue that they might be trying to confuse people with the other measure having to do with homelessness on the ballot, Measure H.
Right. What about the other side? Are they similarly deceptive advertising?
Well, I mean, I know that the Yes on S campaign is certainly not happy about their mailers. There was one that went out about Michael Weinstein, the head of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is the principal backer, financial backer of the Yes on S campaign. You know, they've argued that the attacks on him are unfair and that the focus on him in general is unfair, that people should be paying more attention to the real estate developers who are funding the No campaign. I haven't heard as much from the Yes campaign complaining about specific mailers, but there's definitely a lot of, you know, dispute between the two sides about each other's claims, particularly about this issue of housing and effects on housing.
And this, you know, whenever anything is so controversial or so heated on the ballot, there are always these kinds of, you know, passionate mailers sent out. But is this going beyond the pale?
You know, I couldn't really weigh in on that as an opinion. I think that certainly that the folks that object to them would say that.
Right. Okay. Emily Alpert-Reyes, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Julie Myers joins us to round out the show. Hello.
Hello. And we spent quite a bit of time on Measure S in our show today. Our listeners wanted to spend even more time on it online. If you go on the Nextdoor social network, it's just erupting with crazy Measure S battles. I want people to actually joust to see who wins. It's like so passive aggressive at this point. Well, on Facebook, V. Vlatipas says Prop S will mostly affect luxury housing and zoning rules exist for a reason. Yes on S. Janice Peterson Ratter says my area is being ruined by development, huge complexes, zoning changes from residential to business, traffic, pollution. Screw that. Yes on S. But Tyler Massey says I can't wait to vote no on this dumb measure. We are in a housing crisis for crying out loud. How could we stop development now? Vote no on S.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so who would have thought that a development ballot initiative would elicit such passions?
It's a housing wonk's dream.
Okay, thank you. Julie Myers, thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.